The street lights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the street lights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. Not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering has tore you up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. And Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You're listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK and Scott Reeder. I'm Lacey Scarmana. As we've mentioned before, Stanley Liggins was arrested for aggravated sexual assault of a 9-year-old girl living in Milan, Illinois, and he was released on bond. This was a little over a month before Jennifer Lewis was murdered. The autopsy report showed Jennifer had also been sexually abused. Scott County Attorney Mike Walton and Assistant County Attorney Julie Walton want to prove the connection between what happened to Jennifer and what happened to the other 9-year-old in Milan. During the pretrial hearings in February, the Waltons argued a motion to allow testimony from the girl's mother. We are not going to name the Milan victim or her mother in order to protect their privacy. We will refer to the victim as A.S., which is how she was referenced in court. Julie Walton called A.S.'s mother as a witness during a hearing.
Did a remarkable event occur with regard to A.S. on August 3rd of 1990?
Yes.
And did you respond to your apartment at Milan Manor on August 3rd of 1990?
Could you ask that again, please?
Did you arrive at your apartment? Were you directed to arrive at your apartment at Milan Manor on August 3rd of 1990?
Yes.
With regard to this event that had occurred to A.S.?
Yes.
August 3rd is when the abuse took place. Julie Walton also asked about something that happened during the trial, which took place the following spring of 1991.
At some point, did you guide A.S. out of the courtroom during that trial in the spring of 1991?
Yes.
And did something remarkable occur as you were guiding A.S. out of the courtroom?
Yes.
Can you describe for the court what occurred as you were guiding A.S. out of the courtroom?
Stanley Liggins threatened to kill my daughter.
Prosecutors Mike and Julie Walton argue that Stanley Liggins learned his lesson after he got arrested for sexually abusing A.S.
We also intend with regard to motive and intent. The fact that less than a month a little over a month after the A.S. allegations in which the defendant was arrested and he was out on bond for, a little over a month after those allegations, Mr. Liggins lured Jennifer away and murdered her. And it was clear that that was done based on what he had learned August 3rd of 1990. Because A.S., you'll see from the transcript, screamed, ran for help, and was able to talk to the police and identify Mr. Liggins and what he had done to her, and the police arrested him. So on September 17th of 1990, Mr. Liggins wasn't going to let that happen again. So rather than choose to attack a little girl near her own home and around her friends, he lured her away in his vehicle and he murdered her so that this little girl couldn't talk.
We had the chance to talk with A.S. She's now in her 30s and still lives in the Quad Cities area. In 1990, A.S. was living at Milan Manor Apartments with her mom and sister. Their neighbor was Stanley Liggins' girlfriend, Brenda Adams. A.S. still vividly remembers what happened on August 3rd, 1990. It was a hot day at the end of the summer. She and Brenda's daughter were outside playing in the water. A.S. was wearing a large t-shirt over a bathing suit. She and Brenda's daughter took a break from running around and sat down on some steps to drink Kool-Aid. That's when she spilled some on her leg.
She goes, go in and ask my dad for a wash rag. And I said, okay, you know, so I went in and went down the stairs, and their apartment was in the basement. And in the basement, it's the only apartment that's down there. And then there's one above it on the level that you have to come down. And so I went in there and asked him if I could get a wash rag. He said, yeah, have a seat. I sat at the kitchen table, and he went into the bathroom. He locked the door, went into the bathroom, grabbed the wash rag. And in between this, I think he unlocked the door because they had came in and then left. And then he locked the door and came back out with the wash rag and started washing my legs. Or my leg, and then he pulled my swimsuit over and tried to do it. Well, when he started to, I had stood up, and I don't know if there was a fear in me, so I was trying to think, oh my gosh, how do I get out of this situation? And I want to say I punched him, and when I punched him, he's a big guy, I ended up, I don't know if the Lord was watching over me or what was going on, but I ended up knocking him off his balance enough for me to get out of the kitchen to the door. I got the door unlocked, and as I was opening it, he was trying to close it. So I squeezed out the door, and then he ran after me. As I'm running up the stairs, I get to about the third, fourth stair up, and he started pulling my leg, telling me, don't tell your mom, don't tell your mom. And I'm trying to get my leg loose. So I finally broke free. And this whole time I'm screaming, and it's echoing through this hallway, and nobody comes out. And the first thing I could think of was Charlotte, one of my mom's friends, lived there's an apartment in between her and his apartment. And I thought, I didn't know anybody that lived in that one apartment. And I thought, it's going through my mind, this is so close, I gotta get away from him, you know. And I didn't want to look back and see if he was following me. So I just kept running, and I ended up running to Charlotte's house. And my mom was home at the time, but I just figured if I ran all the way down to my apartment, that he would get me before I got there. So, I ran into Charlotte's, and that's when I started telling her what had happened. And then she called my mom, and my mom came over, and we talked about it. I told her what had happened. And then the police were called, and they came and took a statement, and that's when it all went down.
What went down was Stanley Liggins was arrested for aggravated sexual abuse of a child. But he was able to post bond and was released. Then, a little over a month later, he was arrested for the murder of Jennifer Lewis. A.S. didn't know Jennifer, but she's seen photos and is struck by how similar they looked at that age. And she says their looks are not where the parallels stop.
I feel like if I wouldn't have did what I did and got out of there, I would have been Jennifer Lewis. There's no doubt in my mind that that wouldn't have been me. It just putting two and two together. I went to school at Thomas Jefferson and Milan. Her body was found at Thomas Jefferson in Davenport. No connection between Jennifer Lewis and Thomas Jefferson in Davenport. We were the same age. Look a lot alike. To the point that one of the detectives came by my mom's house and grabbed a picture and said, I really need this for court. And she was just shocked to see how close we looked. Same age. It's sad to even think about it.
They were also living in similar environments. A.S. says she wasn't aware of it at the time, but Mylan Manor was known for the drug use and partying that went on. And she says the types of people that lived or hung out there, like drug dealers, drug users, partiers, and so on, made it a pretty unsafe environment for kids.
My mom did what she could afford. Looking back on it now, if I was stuck in a situation that she was in, I would prefer to go to a homeless shelter than to put my kids in a living environment like that.
When a reporter asked Stanley back in 1990 about the charge related to AS, as well as the sexual abuse of Jennifer Lewis, Stanley denied both by saying,
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
It's just sick and twisted, and it upset me because somebody so heartless and cold doesn't care what he did to people's lives or their family members or how they have to go on and live their life. I mean, I want to say that what happened to me is so small but so big compared to Jennifer. And for my life to be miserable for something that was so small that was yet so big, that now her family has to deal with. I'm still alive. I'm still here. I still get to see my family. I still get to have kids. I'm married, you know. Unfortunately, Jennifer isn't able to do that. And for somebody to hear that over and over again, it's just horrible. He's a monster.
She's still living with the impact today.
Well, I have a 13-year-old daughter, first of all, and a 10-year-old son that you want to shelter to a certain extent and try to let them have a normal life, but you've went through all this and you've dealt with it for so many years that it's so hard to let them have a little bit of freedom. So I do have that in the back of my mind, with especially my daughter being 13, that, you know, I need to hold her close, make sure nothing happens to her. But it can happen to anybody. My husband, I mean, it's a lot for her. I haven't really shared a lot with him on what has happened. I mean, briefly, we talk about it and discuss what's going on currently, but as far as my case and back in the day, it's just been a little, this is what happened, and that's it. Safety for my kids. If something happens and he gets out, I worry about that all the time, nonstop. I had an alarm put on my house. I went and got my FOIA card. I'm going to take some classes. I've just been told by people that I need to be prepared if it does happen. So it's scary.
The FOID card AS mentioned is a firearm owner's identification card, an Illinois gun permit. She says it's important for her kids to understand why she's so protective. She's explained to her daughter what happened.
I told her what had happened, and that if I ever tell her she can't stay at a friend's house or hang out with somebody, that it's because I don't have a good feeling and that I'm not doing it to hurt her. that I'm doing it to protect her, and I hope one day she'll understand. And she understands. She asked me questions about, you know, in more detail what had happened, and I'm not one to hide it or sugarcoat it because I feel she should be aware of her surroundings. And so far, we're doing good.
Today, AS works for a defense attorney as a criminal paralegal.
I come across a couple of cases that are defending people like Stanley that you gotta kind of, especially with me, you gotta kind of put your feelings aside and figure out, you know, they're innocent until they're proven guilty. So, I've always been into the criminal shows. It's like a big puzzle piece that you try to put together. I've worked in family law. I've done taxes. I've done real estate. But I always wanted to be in criminal. So I don't know if it was because the incident that happened, I wouldn't say, drew me to that. More or less, I've just always been interested in trying to put the puzzle pieces together.
We talked to Jill Levinson, a professor of social work at Barry University in Miami. She's also a treatment provider in a sex offender treatment program in Florida. She hasn't spoken with Stanley Liggins or AS, but she does say it's normal for adults to still have trauma for abuse or events that happened when they were children.
It's different for everybody, of course, but yes, very typical. And that's why I think it is, you know, sometimes those incidents that occur only once might seem minor, and it might seem like they're really minimal. But what becomes important then is how the child interprets it. And so being victimized by somebody, having that sense that somebody else is exhibiting power over you, having a trusted adult betray that trust, having an adult threaten you maybe and say, don't tell anybody or I'll hurt you or hurt your family is very traumatizing. Having an unexpected event like this occurring, if you're a child and you're expecting that adults are reliable and dependable and they're going to be appropriate caretakers and somebody says, I'm going to help you get cleaned up because you spilled something, and instead they end up abusing you, that's very traumatizing because it shakes the sense that the world is a predictable, safe place.
Stanley Liggins was convicted of the aggravated sexual abuse of AS in April of 1991. At his sentencing, he read a statement to the judge. Here's Scott Reeder reading a portion of the statement.
First of all, I would like to say that I'm not guilty of this offense, and I do apologize for everyone here and everyone concerned in this incident. When the little girl was giving her statement, she didn't seem like she was upset. It seemed like she was having fun to me. That's just my opinion. When Mrs. Allen was interviewing me, I was kind of skeptical because I have the tendency to not trust very many people. I have been like that for 10 or 11 years. I have good reason to be like that. I am adjusting, but it's hard. I have been through a lot. I am adjusting to it. I do apologize for everything. Not that I'm admitting guilt, I'm not. But as far as the sentences go, I don't feel like I deserve a day for anything. I am not guilty of anything. So, it's pretty obvious that we have somebody who doesn't have any remorse for the crime that he's been convicted of.
But when we were interviewing this woman who had been victimized by Stanley Liggins,
she wept. She was very emotional. It was an extremely horrific thing that she went through as a 9-year-old. How anybody could say that she was having fun testifying as a child in a courtroom where she was cross-examined by the defense and she had to answer difficult questions and relive the horror of what she'd been through is absolutely beyond me. In a lot of ways, reading this transcript, I think sheds even more light on Stanley Liggins' absolute lack of empathy.
Empathy is what allows us to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes and imagine what they're feeling. We don't necessarily have to go through the exact same situation as somebody to be able to get a sense of their emotions. A lack of empathy, says Jill Levinson, can lead to criminal or victimizing behavior.
Because if you don't really have the capacity to understand how somebody else feels, then you're not really going to have true remorse or regret when you do something that harms someone else.
Again, Stanley was convicted of sexually abusing AS, but since his last murder conviction was vacated by the court, he hasn't currently been found guilty of anything related to Jennifer Lewis. But we have discussed his pattern of criminal behavior before. He served time for armed robbery. His prison records from that time show an allegation of attempted rape of another inmate. And he was acquitted of murder on the grounds of self-defense after stabbing another inmate at least 11 times. Trial testimony from the Jennifer Lewis case revealed that he was dealing cocaine, and he assaulted his cellmate in the Rock Island County Jail over two magazines. We asked Jill Levinson what kinds of factors could lead a person to this lifestyle.
Again, not having met him, I'll just talk in generalities, which is that we know that this might have been a child who grew up, we know, in impoverished conditions, that moved around a bit, that maybe had an absent parent, that maybe had some stability and security in his life, but lacked some consistency and reliability in other ways. And, you know, children in the same family can respond very differently to the same kinds of conditions. And but what we do know is that growing up with environmental conditions that may be adverse and deprivational can affect people biologically and socially. So environmental deprivation actually can change the architecture of the brain, which then affects later in life as kids grow up their ability to regulate their own emotions and their own behavior. We also know that, again, psychologically and socially, growing up in adverse conditions can just kind of create a personality that's more callous and more entitled and more about just doing what you need to do to survive. So, and I say all this, again, not to excuse or condone criminal or victimizing behavior or murder, of course, but rather to, you know, kind of contextualize what we know about early adversity and trauma.
She does say sexual murder of children is a pretty rare phenomenon.
So they could be driven by different kinds of motivations, and of course it's hard to know what the motivations could have been in this particular case. On the one hand, there are people who engage in these kinds of behaviors because they're driven by some sort of sadistic tendencies. They're aroused by sexual abuse of children, and in particular, you know, harming and humiliating and causing pain to other people. On the other hand, you could have a situation where a person sexually molested a child, and then that child told and reported the abuse. And then in that case, if they reoffend again, there might be more motivation to try to cover up the evidence in an effort not to get caught.
And that's exactly what the prosecution tried to suggest in the hearing. Mike and Julie Walton argued that since AS fought back and told on Stanley, which led to his arrest, that Stanley wasn't going to let that happen again. And that, they argue, is why he killed Jennifer. But defense attorney Derek Jones responded by saying the crimes against AS and Jennifer Lewis were not all that similar.
You have 2 9-year-old children that resemble each other in some superficial ways, but what happened to those two children are remarkably different. The current case involves allegations of penetration, injury, and death. The allegations in the AS case were that Mr. Liggins had taken a washcloth and cleaned off some Kool-Aid on AS's leg, and then he'd moved her underwear aside and he touched her vagina on the exterior only with a washcloth. There was no penetration. There's obviously no homicide. And there's no other, I mean, there's nothing else to really compare the two things other than it's a 9-year-old. It's a child sex abuse in both cases, but there's nothing specific or individualized that says the way AS was harmed matches the way JL in our case was harmed.
Ultimately, 7th Judicial District Chief Judge Marlita Grieve denied the prosecution's motion to allow the testimony from AS's mom. To quote from the ruling, even though the sexual abuse was not as severe as what happened to Jennifer Lewis, evidence defendant was convicted of sexual abuse against AS most certainly will enrage, disgust, and prejudice a jury against defendant. And then the ruling continues, the probative value of this evidence is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to defendant and would be inadmissible. And this ruling wasn't particularly surprising. It's extremely difficult to bring up a defendant's prior bad acts in a trial. And that's because the fact that a person commits one crime doesn't necessarily mean that they are responsible for all other potential charges brought against them. And remember, that's the reason Stanley Liggins' first conviction was overturned. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled that bringing his drug dealing history into the trial was prejudicial to the jury. Bill Davis, the former Scott County attorney and the prosecutor on the first two trials against Stanley Liggins, explains the few cases when prior bad acts are admissible.
In Iowa, felonies don't come in unless they have been committed within 10 years of the act that the person is now charged with, rule number one. Number two, the evidence that you want to get in must be a crime of dishonesty. Perjury, bad checks, theft, burglary when theft is included. If a person testifies in Iowa, the defendant, he's subject to cross-examination only as to what he's testified to. But in federal court and in Illinois, the prosecution is allowed to point out to the jury that this person has been previously convicted of a felony, any felony, or a misdemeanor if it's a crime of dishonesty. That is to impeach their testimony. That is to say, this person commits crimes. This person commits acts of dishonesty. Therefore, you shouldn't believe him, or you should keep that in mind when weighing what he has to say.
So why would Mike and Julie Walton even try to bring this testimony in if it's to be expected that a judge won't allow the mention of prior bad acts? Here's Bill's take.
We've adopted a statute. The legislature has. But you have to keep in mind the Supreme Court is still reluctant to let crimes of other crimes into evidence in a particular case, any kind. So they read this with a jaundiced eye. But that particular statute says that anyone being tried for sexual abuse makes prior crimes of sexual abuse admissible under certain circumstances, but the judge has the ability to weigh whether or not that evidence can be more prejudicial than it is evidentially beneficial to the trial or the trier of fact being the juror.
And Scott Reeder has another theory.
Now, forgive me because I've spent most of my life as a political reporter, not a legal reporter, but as the late Mayor Daley once said, politics is everywhere, even in the church. And I think politics is also something that you can see in the courthouse, and particularly in how lawyers interact with judges and other folks. And one of the things that runs through my mind is perhaps the prosecution was hoping to use this as a way of putting some pressure on the judge not to consider a directed verdict, you know, where it wouldn't even go to the jury and she would just direct them to a not guilty verdict for insufficient evidence or whatever. Perhaps there was some pressure being played on the judge indirectly by the prosecution. Hey, if you give a directed verdict in this, everybody in the community is going to know this is something else that he did, and he was convicted of it. And this is what the mother of the victim says he said afterwards. just maybe there's a little bit of politics going on there. Maybe I'm totally wrong here. I don't know. It's always hard to know the exact motives for what other people do, but that thought has crossed my mind.
And here's Scott with another excerpt from the 1991 statement Stanley Liggins read at his sentencing hearing for the AS conviction.
I feel like I was found guilty because of other things that are pending. That's what I really believe. If someone would be found guilty of this, they wouldn't. It would probably just be a slap on the wrist. But since it's me, and I'm an ex-con, well, let's put it like this. Once you are incarcerated, and you have been convicted of a crime, and you are released into society, if anything happens in the vicinity that you are in, you are automatically guilty until proven guiltier. And that's the way it was for me.
Casey Stengel was the prosecutor in that case. It took place in Rock Island County, on the Illinois side of the Quad Cities. And Casey later went on to become a 14th Judicial Circuit judge in Illinois. He says that, no, Stanley Liggins wouldn't have been found guilty simply because of his prior conviction for armed robbery.
Just because you're charged with a crime, that doesn't enter into you being found guilty or not. It only affects the sentence. Because Stanley never took the stand. So the judge would not have known whether or not Stanley Liggins had a prior conviction in Mississippi unless Stanley Liggins took the stand. Now, unless maybe the judge read the newspaper, but legally, the judge would not have any knowledge of Stanley Liggins' record or would not take that into account in determining whether or not Stanley Liggins was guilty of the crime. So, you know, Stanley Liggins is mixing apples with oranges there. I mean, it's two different things. I mean, his prior criminal record affected the sentence here. His prior criminal record may have influenced Stanley Liggins not taking the stand, though.
Casey remembers A.S.'s demeanor during her testimony.
You know, I found her to be very credible because, you know, her story never changed. And she didn't seem afraid in the courtroom. I don't think it was a situation that was embarrassing to her. I mean, in some of these cases of aggravated criminal sexual abuse where the child, it goes on for a long period of time, you know, they are ashamed of what they were allowing, what was happening. At the time, they didn't know what was wrong. They later on find it's wrong, so they might be ashamed. The victim in this case, she wasn't ashamed at all. I mean, she was just a little girl who had some Kool-Aid spilled on her. You know, the last thing she thought of when she woke up in the morning is that she was going to be a victim of a crime. Just by happenstance, you know, this guy takes advantage of her because he sees a quick chance to commit a crime.
We are extremely grateful that A.S. sat down with us to talk about her case and the lasting impact of the sexual abuse. She says it's difficult to relive that experience, but it was important for her to speak up.
I am just so sorry for their loss. I feel horrible. Nobody deserves this. But like Scott said, you know, she's got to live on and with. For me to do this interview was because in a sense I'm trying to help her, and I think justice needs served, and he needs to pay for what he did.
Production support comes from Alfredo Monteca. A big thanks to Colin Thompson and Cast Media for our online presence. And thank you to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and the WVIK staff. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD-TV Channel 8.